Good afternoon. Welcome to the House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development for Friday, the show you've all been waiting for. We finally get to hear some bills. We have some on the docket here, and I recognize it's Friday afternoon. Some people have some places to travel, so we'll get right to it and open a public hearing on House Bill 2261. Troy.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2261 specifies the provisional driver's license restrictions do not apply to persons 18 years of age or older, amends ORS 807.122 to direct Department of Transportation to place restrictions on operation with provisional driver's license, including age and number of passengers, time of operating a vehicle, destination restrictions, and employment circumstances. There is a fiscal and revenue impact. The fiscal impact reads no expenditure impact. The revenue impact reads no revenue impact.
Very good. And do we have someone from ODOT who would like to be heard on the bill to give us some background? Here comes Amy. Yes, please.
Chair Reed and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. House Bill 2261 is a true housekeeping bill. It has to do with the graduated driver license program, so just a little bit of background on that. When a teen wants to get their driver license, there is, before the license is issued, a driver education and practicum period of time. You'll hear a little bit about that later in the hearing on a driver ed bill that we have. But once the teen receives their driver license, there are restrictions on their abilities to drive. This was a law passed back in 1999, and the restrictions put on the teens have had, along with driver's ed, just tremendous life-saving results. It's a fantastic story, and I'd be happy to talk about that in particular with driver's ed coming up a little later on. But the driver's ed restrictions, when those were passed in 1999, were meant to apply for the first year of licensure or until the teen turned 18, whichever comes first. Unfortunately, it's come to the department's attention that there is some ambiguity in the law and that in some rare cases, law enforcement are citing young people who are over the age of 18 but have had that driver license for less than 1 year, and they're being cited for driving outside of the graduated driver license restrictions. So the bill quite simply clarifies that once the person turns 18, those restrictions end and they have a full-blown Class C driver's license with no restrictions. First of all, it comports with the intent of the law when it was passed. Secondly, it's quite simply the better policy. We don't want 17-year-olds holding on until they turn 18 to get that driver license in the expectation that they don't want those restrictions on them. And thirdly, it provides a lot of clarity to law enforcement, to judges, and to the people providing driver's education, and to parents and teens. We know exactly what the rules are, and we can tell our teens, the driver's ed folks know what to tell their students. It provides the clarity that's really necessary in this area. So this is the department's bill. We're in favor, and would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much for the explanation. Other questions? I don't see any. So we have a couple of other people who would like to testify. If you would be so kind as to stick around in case that engenders any additional questions. You don't necessarily have to stay there, but please don't leave the room. Sandra Bishop and Lori Nosak. Hopefully I have the name pronounced correctly. Is Lori here?
She is, but in respect for time, we probably don't both need to come up.
Okay.
Sandra Bishop, Representative Reed, members of the committee. I'm representing the Driving School Association of Oregon. Lori Nosak is one of our commercial driving school owners, so she's here if you have any questions, but probably not on this. We just want to say this was the original intent of the graduated driver's license when it passed in 99. So we appreciate the clarification and we support it. Good bill should pass. Thank you.
Very good. That's short and sweet. We appreciate it. That's the full list of people who signed up to testify. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House Bill 2261? Not seeing anyone. Given the short testimony and unanimous testimony, I'm going to take the risk of closing the public hearing and opening a work session on House Bill 2261.
Big risk.
Representative Benz.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2261 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Benz has moved House Bill 2261 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, you're taking an awful big risk.
Representative Cameron, well, you know, it is a little bit of a risk when I haven't been able to even hear a whole lot here. So.
He's a risk taker.
That's me. Okay. No discussion. Is there any objection to the motion? I don't see any. The motion carries. The vote is sent to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Representative Doherty, are you okay to carry the bill?
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Representative Doherty. We'll carry and we'll close the work session on House Bill 2261 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2262.
Troy. House Bill 2262-1 confirms Oregon statutes with changes to federal law related to commercial driving privileges, defines commercial driving privileges for purposes of Oregon Vehicle Code, describes persons who hold commercial driving privileges, revised statutes relating to suspension of commercial driving privileges, creates commercial learner driver permit, prescribes fees, privileges, limitations of permit, requires criminal background check of persons administering examinations for criminal driving license and commercial learner driver permits, declares emergency effective upon passage.
Thank you. Is that you too, Amy? Come on up, please.
Chair Reed and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation, here on House Bill 2262, the department's bill that we bring nearly every session to sync up Oregon's laws on commercial driver licenses, commercial driving privileges, to sync up with changes that have happened in the federal regulations over the past 2 or so years. A little bit of background here. The federal government heavily regulates the commercial driver license, commercial motor vehicle operations, and basically states are tasked with adopting those regulations and then implementing the program, running it through the DMV, and Oregon certainly does that. The risk that a state runs in not doing exactly what the feds tell us to do is a loss of federal funding. In my written testimony, I get down into the dollars and cents there, but we're talking about multiple millions of dollars potentially lost every year if Oregon were to fail to sync up with the federal requirements. And in addition, if the state continued to fail to sync up, the federal government could decertify the commercial driver license in Oregon, making it effectively useless outside of our borders. So we do this nearly every session, and I will try to not bore you with the details of the bill. There's a section-by-section description of what every bit of this bill does attached, but some of the highlights are the creation in the federal law of the commercial learner permit. Oregon law has had a commercial instruction permit for some time for those trying to learn how to operate a big rig and then prior to them getting a commercial driver license. The feds have come in and established this commercial learner permit, put some restrictions and requirements on it that are different from what Oregon had had up to this time. So it syncs up with that. It also goes into quite a bit of detail about suspensions, revocations, cancellations that happen for various offenses that people may commit if they have a commercial driver license, a commercial learner permit, or don't have those privileges but are operating a commercial motor vehicle. Again, the federal regulations extremely prescriptive about what offenses have to meet up with what suspensions and what length of suspension and whether they are consecutive or concurrent, all of that in this very exciting 40-page bill. You have before you, too, I hope, a Dash 1 amendment.
We do.
That, again, in crafting a 40-page, highly technical bill, some items were missed, some things got added in that didn't need to be there, so that Dash 1 takes care of those couple of things. I've been in discussions with Mr. Russell of the Oregon Trucking Association, who, as you might guess, takes a keen interest in this bill every time, and I believe that Mr. Russell and I have come to agreement that what is in this bill is exactly nothing more and nothing less than what the federal government requires of this state, but I will leave any further comments to him, and I welcome any questions.
And he is scheduled to testify next, so we'll hear from him. If there aren't other questions, I might ask one, which is might be most appropriate coming from me and Vice Chair Benson, Representative Davis. Is this sort of the transportation equivalent to what we talk about in the Revenue Committee as the rolling reconnect? It's just kind of, that's back in sync.
Chair Reed, if I had any idea what the rolling reconnect was, I would say yes, it is.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cameron.
If I remember, the rolling reconnect last time was a minority report in the Revenue Committee.
There was.
Be careful what you ask for.
Well, in the sense that it gives us a chance to decide whether we're going to do exactly what the feds did or not. And in this case, there's a more significant risk if we chose to depart than perhaps in the revenue case. Are there other comments, questions? Mr. Russell?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations, and I'm here in support of House Bill 2262 with the Dash 1 amendments. We think this is a very good thing because what it does is it provides uniformity throughout this country in terms of driver licensing for truck drivers and how they're treated under each state's vehicle code. So it's very positive. Ms. Sinclair and I did spend a great deal of time going through this line by line, and I concur that it is an accurate reflection of the federal requirements, and it's more like permanent reconnect than rolling reconnect.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Any questions? Okay, I don't see any. Thank you. That completes the list of people who have signed up. Is there anyone who would like to testify on House Bill 2262? I don't see any. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2262 and open a work session on House Bill 2262. Representative Betts.
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the Dash 1 amendments to HB 2262.
Thank you. Representative Benz has moved the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2262. Is there any discussion? Any objection? I don't see any. The Dash 1 amendments are adopted. Representative Benz, you will note, I'm sure as I did, that there is a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2262 as amended to the due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you. Representative Benz has moved House Bill 2262 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? I don't see any objection. I don't see any. The motion carries, and it was sent to the floor and on to Ways and Means. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2262 and move on to House Bill 2263 and open the public hearing. Troy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 2263 codifies fee for show licenses, proposes to raise fee for three regulated industries, vehicle dealers, dismantlers, and appraisers, so that the cost of enforcing regulations is covered by fee revenue, prescribes timeline for applying application requirements, types of fees, penalty for not receiving permit, and paying fee, establishes an additional $150 late fee for failure to pay fees by date the fee is due. There is no or minimal expenditure impact on the fiscal and no revenue impact on the revenue impact.
Thank you. Not Amy on this one. Who's here from DMV?
Chair Reed, members of the committee, my name is Tom McClellan. I'm the DMV Administrator with the Department of Transportation here to testify on House Bill 2263. The bill is an agency bill. It adjusts business licensing fees for vehicle dealers, dismantlers, and other vehicle-related businesses that we are responsible for regulating. Fee increases is required to maintain this self-supporting activity that we do. And we have been in contact with the impacted industries to get their input and their support, I believe, for this change. DMV's business regulation section licenses and monitors vehicle-related businesses and issues temporary permits, trip permits, dealer place to certified dealerships. And we investigate improper activity among those licensed businesses and unlicensed businesses as well. Certain activities that we are responsible for can be charged to the State Highway Fund, but the majority of the activity is fee-supported. The fees that they pay to be regulated are what pay for those activities that we are conducting, including the unlicensed activity that takes place with dealers, with individuals selling vehicles that are not licensed dealerships. During the last time these fees were changed was in 2001. Any increase really of any significance. We did go from 1 year to 3 year licenses, and so the fees were tripled at that point, but they were good for 3 years instead of one. So it's been many years since we've had any real adjustments to these fees. The balance in the Transportation Operating Fund that we use for this activity has gradually declined over time. Took a pretty good hit over the last few years as fewer dealerships were paying into the fund, but the workload remained pretty constant. And sometimes it actually increases during economic downturns. So we are asking for this fee increase from you through this bill. You'll note that the increases affecting dismantlers, wrecking yards in the state are a higher proportion than those of the other industries affected here. The reason for that is that what we found over the years is that the cost to administer these activities, this program, is comparable to what it is for a dealership. Dismantler licensure inspections are fairly comparable to what it is for a regular auto car dealership. So we're raising those fees closer to what the dealerships are paying. Also, the supplemental dismantler certificate, we're putting that at the same price, same cost as a standard license would be. Again, we found that when a dismantler operates a supplemental location, it's actually very similar, comparable to actually opening a new business. So the workload, again, is very similar. So we're proposing that fee be comparable at I think it's $800. So with that, we would encourage your support of this bill. We have worked with the industry. We have a Oregon Dealer Advisory Committee that we've worked with very closely on this. We've taken their input and adjusted some of these rates in accordance with that input. So this is what we are recommending. Take any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Just to make sure I understood you correctly, on the supplemental certificate for the dismantler, which according to I think it's your testimony, it goes from the handout I'm looking at, it goes from 90 to 800. Did I hear you right to say that it was previously based on the thought that it wouldn't be as much work for a second location, and in fact it's more like opening a first? Is that what I heard you say?
Yeah, Chair Reed, that is true. Okay. Over the years, the amount expected of us as a regulatory agency has also increased around dismantlers. Much more inspection, much more paperwork that's expected of them to maintain information about inventory and the destruction of vehicles.
Very good. Thank you. Are there other questions? Representative Gorsuch.
So to go back to that $90 to $800, and you've talked to people in the industry.
Yes, we have.
And they didn't have a problem with going from...
And Representative Gorsuch, I'll just break in. We do have four people who are going to testify who probably will be able to answer
questions. Oh, good. Okay. Too. It just seems... All right. Okay.
Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Subtle. I'm sorry, I missed it.
Careful where I point that thing. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom, thanks for being here. So you said that during the economic downturn, the workload actually increased. Can you explain that and talk about why the costs are actually going up with less dealers, et cetera?
Chair Reed, Representative Cameron. Our costs have stayed fairly constant, but what happens when a dealership goes out of business is typically a lot more work in the unwinding of that business and inventory issues, paperwork. So our investigators are spending more time in those areas. So it's more time associated with the cost of that. We've held some positions vacant in this area. The problem is we're not getting to those inspections and those investigations as quickly and as timely as we should as a result of that. So what we're trying to do is maintain our costs and staffing levels as best we can. But the number of dealerships that we're responsible for, you know, is fewer right now than what it was 3-4 years ago, primarily because of the economy. But we're still being called to respond to complaints, to investigate issues. So the workload is still there. And sometimes, like I said, it can be more because of that.
Oh, no, reserve. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? I don't see any. So we have four people who have signed up to testify, and I think maybe we'll just call them up in pairs. With Mike Wagner and Marianne Trout. Whoever would like to start, please begin by introducing yourself. And
Representative Reed and members of the committee, my name is Mike Wagner. I own a tow company and a company that sells tow trucks up the Santiam Canyon in Lyons, Oregon. So I have an Oregon dealer's license, and I also have an appraiser's license as part of my function of having a tow company. I have been a member of the ODAC committee, which is the Oregon Dealers Advisory Committee. I've been a member since 2004. And served as the chair of ODAC from 2009 until our last meeting, in which I'm now the vice chair. So,
I hope it wasn't anything you did at that last meeting.
Yeah. No, I think we're okay. They picked a new one, Marianne, here is our new chair. And
very good.
She wanted me to be the new vice chair, and so we just kind of switched positions. She was my vice chair for all those years. So.
Terrific.
We're seeing if the mentoring process works. But, in my spare time, I'm chairman of the North Santiam School District School Board, too. So I have my dabbling in politics and
thank you.
Have enjoyed very much the wonderful climate we've had in education last year. So appreciate anything you can do there, too. So anyway, I think Tom explained a little bit what the ODAC committee is, and so I won't spend any time there. ODAC has actually voted on this measure twice, and the support has been unanimous. Now, he didn't explain who makes up ODAC. I guess I should maybe fill you in there. It's people from the automotive industry. So we have dismantlers. I happen to be the towing representative on the front. We have an insurance representative. We have a representative from the office managers that work for dealerships. We have new car dealers, used car dealers. We have a consumer rep. We have a motorsports rep. I've probably forgot somebody, but that's the general groups that we have. So it is a broad-based committee that's an advisory committee to DMV, and we are able to we hash out issues that are automotive, DMV registration, enforcement, that sort of thing, and we hash those issues out pretty regularly in our I think we have three meetings a year now. So anyway, it was 2263 was voted on twice. We voted again at our last meeting that we had a couple new people on the committee and just wanted to make sure that everybody was still on board with what we've done. I might answer the question that Representative Cameron asked about why enforcement activities might go up during a recession. And one of the things that happens is unlicensed dealer activity does go up during a recession. Folks are looking for ways to make a buck. And seems like buying and selling cars might be an easy way to turn a few dollars. And so, you know, all of a sudden you've got somebody that's buying and selling 4, 5, 6 cars a month, and that's a no-no. You're supposed to have a license to do that. So, and of course, the reason we'd want a license is to make sure that the consumer's protected and those transactions are handled in a way that would be applicable to what the law says. So I'd be open. I think that's all I have to say. I'd be open to any questions you might have.
Thank you. Maybe we'll hear from Ms. Trout and then take questions for you both, please.
Hi, Chair Reed and members of the committee. I'm Marianne Trout. I'm from Hillsborough Auto Wrecking. I'm one of the owners. I'm on ODAC committee. I'm one of two of the dismantler representatives. I'm also the new chair. The industry is in support of House Bill 2263. Our fees haven't been increased for many years. We would like to keep the inspectors to keep our industry running up the way it's supposed to be running and to keep the unlicensed dismantlers at bay. I have made contact with the larger dismantlers because the two on ODAC are we're small businesses. We're not the larger ones, which are the supplemental dismantlers that you're asking about. And they are also in favor of the fee increase along with the supplemental increase. I'm going to just touch on the supplemental part. There's a little over 300 dismantlers in the state of Oregon. There's probably a handful of yards that have supplemental locations, and they might have, you know, they're the ones that have 2 to 6 locations. They have the same name, but they operate as the same big business just like the rest of us. It's not a toned-down version. It's the same auto dismantler business. In order to keep our fees low enough to keep the inspectors and to support DMV and the regulation that we want, we found it only fair to make the supplemental licensees move up to the same price that the rest of us are needing to pay. And so the census in the industry is that that was a fair thing to do. So if you have any questions.
Other questions? Representative Cameron.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe these questions, we probably need DMV to come back up here or something. But I'm curious. All these fees go into the same budget line. Is the same inspector or inspectors inspect all the areas that are coming under these fee increases?
It's multiple inspectors. I'm not sure how many. They have inspectors that are in different parts of the state.
Reinforcement is arriving.
You can answer that. For the record, I'm Tom McClellan, DMV Administrator. It is the same pool of funds. It's the same. The Transportation Operating Fund takes the revenues in from all these different industries that pay into it, and the inspectors are paid out of that single fund, whether they're inspecting a dismantler or tow company, is also a dealership, or new car dealership. It's all paid out of the same fund.
Okay, great. So follow-up, there's going to be a few of these questions. Sure. And I know this isn't Ways and Means, but we're going to be approving some substantial increases here. So what's that total fund, or what was that total fund in the last biennium, and what's it projected to be with these fee increases?
Let's see if I got that. Chair Tobias, Representative Cameron. Fiscal year 2008, it was just under $800,000. As of the end of fiscal year 2011, it was about $384,000. We're forecasting that by 2015, it'll be about $200,000, dropping below. It'll be a negative. It will never be negative, but it would drop below by fiscal year 2017 without the fee increases. With the fee increases, we can maintain a range of about $335,000 to $650,000. From a cash flow standpoint, we consider that a reasonable amount to make it through a year. We don't want it to drop much below that. So with these fee increases, it kind of stabilizes that decrease that we were seeing over time and prevents us from running out of money in this fund early enough that we can catch it and not have to have significant increases upon the industry.
Okay. Well, if I may?
Yes, please.
That's okay. So, and Tom, maybe you have numbers on inspections during those years as well, how many inspections were made?
Representative Cameron, I do not have that with me right now. I could get
activity-type
data for you if you'd like.
That would be great information to have. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Following up on that last question, in addition to number of inspections, I'd like to know, so then what was the result of those inspections? 10% of the time you substantiated a complaint, 90% of the time, what kind of follow-up is there? Because you can do lots of inspections, but if you're not finding anything, that's different than, wow, we've done a really good job, we needed to protect the public. Over half the time there was something that needed to be addressed. So I'd like one step further. The other line of inquiry I have is, I don't know this industry at all. I'm not familiar with the business models. I don't quite understand what supplemental is or what it means. Does it mean establishing a second site where someone who already does the business in one town wants to open up a similar business in another town? So if it's supplemental, it's not exactly like a branch, but I think I understand in part that, yes, there's going to be a new activity that needs to be monitored, but are there no similarities, there are no savings because the organization itself, the management of it, is the same? I would have expected at least a somewhat reduced rate for the second site if it's under the same ownership. So I'd like to understand a little more about that and what that says about the impact this has on the private sector. Does it tend to encourage or discourage competition? What's the impact on the marketplace?
There are a lot of questions in there. Maybe in the interest of folks, we could do one at a time.
Sure. Yeah. But
maybe you could just ask one, and then we could hear the answers. I was having trouble remembering all the ones that were. They're probably better than me, but.
Yeah. Okay. Chair Reed, Representative Nathanson, a supplemental for dismantlers is basically. We used to be called wrecking yards. I don't know if you're familiar with that term. Okay. So now it's fancy, an auto dismantler. So so basically what a supplemental is that you'll have one yard and they'll buy out another yard. And they'll just change their name to keep it the same. So say, for instance, if I bought a second yard, it might be still Hillsborough Auto Wrecking Yard 2 in a different town. It would still be a wrecking yard. It would still have everything entailed that would be, you know, paperwork, cars. It would be just like running a separate business, but it would have our name. So that's what a supplemental location is in our industry. Mm-hmm. I don't know the other question you had was.
Well, it's curious to me that if there's a common ownership mm-hmm. for two or more sites, that the fee is exactly the same for each site, because it might be a little bit like opening up a branch, if you will. I'm just curious about that, and the fact that it's going to be the same cost, or it's pretty mm-hmm. expensive. How will that impact the marketplace? Will that encourage or discourage individual ownership of sites? Or maybe it has no impact at all. For example, does it tend to cause some consolidation and fewer owners overall, or it really has no impact?
The impact seems to be that they own more wrecking yards, so therefore they have more inventory. So it makes competition harder. It still costs the smaller guy the same, yet the larger guy is kind of taking over more, say. Mm-hmm. I couldn't testify that it hurts the consumer any mm-hmm. in that regards, to be honest.
That's getting at what I was okay. curious about. Thank you.
Okay. You want to ask any more? Mm-hmm. Okay. Very good. Other questions? Thank you very much. We have two more people to testify, Daryl Fuller and Monty King.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Monty King. I'm the president of Oregon Vehicle Dealers Association, Oregon Power Sports Association, and the Auto Appraisers of Oregon. So I'm going to have to take the heat from the industry about these rate increases. I'm already doing it. There are a lot of people who don't want to pay government more money for their licensing. So I have to explain to them kind of what you've gone through here of DMV has done a very masterful job of finding out what the workload is for each one of these kinds of businesses that they're regulating and relating that to the funds, the cost of their licensing. We knew back in 2001, 2003, 2005 that the dismantler industry was going to cost a lot of money to regulate. But first they had to find out how much regulation they needed. because they were only getting charged, what, $90 or something like that. So the dealers basically said at that point, we'll carry the ball here. We'll carry the money for our with our increased rates until you can figure out how much they should be charged. And that's what's happened. And that's why these rates for the dismantlers have gone higher. A vehicle dealer supplemental is not like a dismantler supplemental. So that's why, you know, there is a difference in the supplemental rates between the two of them. They're not even the same at all. As far as why regulation went up, because of the bad guys. We are for this bill because we want to keep those six investigators because they go after the bad guys. Right? Our association and the other associations are not here to help support bad dealers. Along with Department of Justice actions, that's what we got to go after. We got to go after these crappy people. Excuse me, I shouldn't have said that. We got to go after the people who are dealing vehicles without a dealer license. We call them curbers. There's a lot of them out there. Every time the rate increase goes up, it happened in 83, it happened in 2001, we've said if we're going to increase rates for dealers, we want more action on the unlicensed activity. I'm glad to say that we've seen a little bit of increase in that, but I think we could, I hope for more this time. I'd like for them to set one guy just on unlicensed activity, just to see how it would work for a year. Right now, we got six areas out there where six people are doing the investigations for all of these activities that are included in the bill. So DMV has been very good to work with overall. Their leadership has always listened. I've been going to the Oregon Dealer Advisory Committee. I'm not on it, but I've been going there since 1997. I've only missed two meetings. And along with Daryl, we probably hit every meeting, and we're kind of like the institutional memory of the group because they come, they go, kind of like legislators, really. So we're going to support the bill because we want to go after the bad guys. That's really what it's about. I mean, any questions?
Thank you, Mr. King. Let's hear from Mr. Fuller, and then we'll take questions.
Daryl Fuller, also on behalf of the Oregon Vehicle Dealers Association. We submitted some electronic testimony that you guys have, so I won't go through that. Mr. King, my boss has done a good job of explaining the interest that the industry has in making sure that it's a well-regulated industry. It protects both the dealers and the consumers. In a lot of instances, you will find that the regulators and the regulated see each other as cops and robbers. The regulators are always out trying to get the good guys, and the good guys that are licensed and following all the rules are saying, why are you hassling me? I'm following all the rules. Go after the guys that are out there that aren't following the rules, which Mr. King mentioned. And through the Oregon Dealer Advisory Committee, which is required by statute, it's a committee that has to meet four times a year or six times a year by statute, get DMV together with the regulated industry, it puts us in a position where we have to work together and cooperate. It's kind of like an old married couple, if you will. You know, there are times we argue about who gets the clicker on the TV, and sometimes we don't know where we want to go out and have dinner together. And there'll be times that we sit in the same room and we don't even want to talk to each other. But ultimately, we have the same interest at heart, and that is on the second largest purchase that a consumer generally makes, which is their automobile after their home, we want to make sure that when they purchase from a licensed dealer, and that there is some level of confidence that the public has in making those purchases because it's a well-regulated industry. And with that, we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Betts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I had a call from some folks the other day in a small town. There were people down the street that were busy. It was a chop shop, I guess is what you would call it, cutting up cars and selling the parts. And so we called the sheriff and called everybody else. If they had like seven cars that were busy whacking up, does this apply to that situation at all?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, yes and no. In the case of a chop shop, you're dealing with somebody who's stolen cars. So that's a criminal act, not necessarily an administrative violation. On the other hand, if they are taking vehicles, granted they've stolen them, and selling them, they still could be sanctioned as an unlicensed dealer. The DMV could still go after them. I think it's $5,000 for every car that you sell illegally.
Buying them illegally.
So it's possible that you could, in addition to criminal sanctions, that you could try to find, or perhaps you couldn't find a way for whatever reason to make criminal sanctions stick. There's a possibility that an administrative agency like DMV could look at that activity and try to find a way to fit it within the unlicensed dealership in the same way. Again, it would depend on sort of how the cars were coming and going and whether or not the sheriffs or the people making complaints made those complaints to the DMV as well, because the sheriff's not necessarily going to think to contact DMV or vice versa.
Actually, I was looking at the dismantle license. Now, I just wonder, because we couldn't find any way to make this criminal. It was just an incredible mess that they were creating in a neighborhood. And so it seems to me like the dismantler license requirement would have given us the leverage to put a stop to it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Betts, that may very well be the case.
Okay.
It's a call from the sheriff's office to the DMV investigator that deals with that part of the state could bring them and the DEQ and a number of people to bear.
Right. Thank you very much.
Question. Representative Cameron.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, gentlemen, for testifying. I think, obviously, we all want to make sure our consumers are protected. I do. Did you, in analyzing this fee increase, did you look at any of the cost per visits, any of the wages of the people who are doing these inspections, any of the retirement benefits of the people that are doing these inspections, and has there been any talk about trying to keep the cost of doing business down of the people who are doing these visits?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, I don't recall ODAC looking at sort of wage and benefit packages per se, because they're all part of the public employee union, and I don't think ODAC is in a position to decide what level the investigators are at in terms of the way the state views them. I can tell you that DMV provides relatively detailed information on the cost and the amount of time that the investigators are spending per regulated sector. So in other words, they can tell you how much time they're spending on dismantler inspections versus an auto dealer inspection. And one of the things that they want to make sure occurs as they adjust their fees is that if 30% of their investigators' time is on auto dealers, then 30% of the income that comes in ought to be from auto dealers. Mr. King referenced that earlier. When the dismantlers first came on, they were unlicensed for a long time. When we started licensing dismantlers, it was kind of a wild guess. Well, what do we charge for regulating a dismantler? We weren't sure. So we made a good estimate of what we thought it would cost. And then as DMV looked at how their employees were spending their time based on consumer complaints, because a lot of the investigations aren't just spot investigations. A lot of what we do are going from complaint to complaint because there aren't a lot of investigators. So you have them sort of marking out where they spend their time and then making sure that the fees that the regulated industry pay sort of match that grid of how much the employees cost, if that makes sense.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cameron, I review every once in a while some of these civil penalty deals they put together. I remember one where the illegal dealer had over 100 vehicles he had sold illegally, and many had odometer rollbacks, all this stuff, but they only charged him with 15, okay, at $2,500 a piece. That's what? $3,750. And I asked, well, you told me there was 100 of them. He said, well, it doesn't do any good to put 100 of them down. It would take us an extra probably week to put all of it together, to do the research and the background documents. And the guy's probably not going to pay anything anyway, because he's probably broke, he doesn't have a dime, or he's going to leave the state before we can get any money out of him as a civil penalty. And you can't put somebody in jail because he owes a civil penalty anyway. I mean, so there's, I think they do think about that kind of a thing of how much more time should I spend on this guy,
yep, that's
where maybe I can go after somebody else. Well,
if I may, yeah, I'm not questioning the allocation of where the time is and the percentages and all that. I'm questioning about how much an hour of the time costs. And that's all I'm saying. Was there any discussion about that or the increase in that with the dealers and the people that are making the decisions or coming here and saying, raise our fees?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Representative Cameron, we didn't do anything like that, but okay. I'll tell you, I Thank see you. The cars of the staff, and they're not driving Mercedes or BMWs.
and I'm sure they're all legally
they just
licensed.
Seem like everybody else. Okay.
Very good. Thank you. Any questions? I don't see any. Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much. So with that, we've completed the list of people who have signed up on House Bill 2263. Is there anyone else who'd like to testify on House Bill 2263? I don't see anyone. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2263 and open a work session on House Bill 2263. Representative Betts.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2263 to the floor with the pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means by prior reference.
Thank you. Representative Benz has moved House Bill 2263 to the floor with the due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there discussion? Representative Cameron.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think I made it clear to you that I'll be a no on this bill. And the reason why is because this is not a general fund issue. It's something that people are saying they need to increase their fees, but there's been no discussion yet in this building about why the cost of labor continues to go through the roof for the state of Oregon. And until I see that and movement towards that, then I'm going to be a no on a fee increase, even though it's not in a general fund.
Thank you, Representative Cameron. And just to reiterate, it's going to, for the benefit of everyone else, it's going to Ways and Means if the motion passes not to the floor.
And just to be clear, we are voting on the policy here as it's stated in the bill.
Understood. I'm not disputing that. Just making clear to everyone else that it's not going immediately
Thank
to
you.
The floor. That's just fine. Thank you, Representative Cameron. Are there so any further discussion? I don't see any. Is there any objection to the motion, noting Representative Cameron's objection? I don't see any. So the motion carries. Please indicate Representative Cameron will be voting no on the motion. And the bill goes to the floor with the due pass recommendation and on to the Ways and Means Committee. Close the work session on House Bill 2263. And I have lost my place momentarily. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2264. Troy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 2264 authorizes Department of Transportation to increase rate of reimbursement for reduced tuition traffic safety education courses provided to low-income students by public school, commercial driver training school, or county. Requires department to adopt rules governing reduced tuition and reimbursement. Requires provider to receive tuition reimbursement to notify students of available or reduced tuition. Authorized department to offer incentives to providers to offer traffic safety education courses in specific geographic areas within Oregon. Permits department to provide or contract for courses under certain conditions. Authorizes department to impose sanctions against providers of traffic safety education courses who violate traffic safety education provisions or rules of the department. There is a fiscal impact statement. The fiscal impact statement reads it's about $210 per student, and the revenue impact statement references no revenue impact.
Very good, thank you. And we have Director Garrett and Troy Costales here to get us started, please.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Again, for the record, I'm Matthew Garrett, Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation, and I do come here as the Director of ODOT, but I also come here today as a father of a 16-year-old, Madeline, and I've had the privilege of participating and seeing the benefits of driver's education, the driver's education program firsthand. So I am here to ask you to expand the use of an educational tool that saves lives. From 1999 to 2011, driver's education courses, along with the teen graduated license program, has helped reduce fatal and injury crashes for teen drivers by more than half. House Bill 2264 extends the reach of the driver's ed program to areas currently underserved across this state. This bill also offers an additional subsidies for low-income students. It also allows the department to equitably enforce the rules associated with this discipline. It replaces the one and only blunt instrument of provider decertification with a range of sanctions for non-compliant providers, thus allowing the department to help providers out, to mentor, to coach, to make better, rather than simply taking them out of the business. I think to conclude my remarks, and then I'll turn it over to Mr. Costales for additional detail and insights, I think when you boil this down, you know, put simply, the goal of the bill is to get more students taking driver education courses, ultimately leading to more life saves. But with that, Mr. Chairman, if I may, I turn it to Troy for some additional insights.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Costales.
Good afternoon, Chair Reed, Vice Chair Gorsuch, Vice Chair Pence, members of the committee. Pleasure to be here this afternoon. My name is Troy Costales. I'm the Administrator of the Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. And I was in this room, or a room just like it, in the 1999 session, when the conversation around teen provisional license and tiering the stages of a teen to learn to drive to get to the Class C license came about. And it was actually the chair of the House Transportation Committee, Representative Bob Montgomery, that is the one that started this. In a bill that is almost identical in number. And at that time, in this room, was asked if the Safety Division would take on the responsibility for the driver education program, which at that time was in the Department of Education. And my response back to the chair and the committee was, if there are things the legislature would like to see done, I'm sure the Department of Education would like to hear those. And the response back was, you didn't hear what I asked. Would you like to take over the responsibility for driver education in the state of Oregon? And that took effect March 1st of 2000. And as Director Garrett pointed out, it has been an absolute success since that time. Thousands of teens don't know what they missed out on by not being involved in a crash or receiving a citation because of the training they received from the professionals around the state, from private industry, as well as from the public sector. For driver training, both in the classroom and behind the wheel. In the mid-2000s, or in 2006, the U.S. Department of Transportation actually came out to Oregon to do a study and say, is this working? And we're hearing great things, so let's lift up the hood of the car and look at the engine to see if it's making a difference. As the graph and the testimony shows you, there has been a reduction, but inside that, there's even a better story. In Oregon, driver education is voluntary, not a mandatory provision of the license. But in 2006-2007, when USDOT researchers looked at it, they determined that the kids that are taking professional driver training outperformed their peers, even though everybody was getting better. There were 11 to 21% fewer crashes by the kids that take driver education, driver training, 40 to 50% fewer traffic convictions, and 50% fewer suspensions. So as Director Garrett pointed out, the intent of these elements of this particular request for the legislation is to increase the number of teens that do take this course because it does save lives, it does make a difference from every corner of the state. The graph that you have of the providers within the state is the bottom line foundation as to why we're asking for the ability, in some cases, to act as a course manager, rely on maybe some public sector folks, or probably more times than not, it'll be a private company that we ask for them to be able to go into a community for a particular period of time where they would not necessarily set up shop simply because of the cost or just the number of students available to them. It wouldn't make sense to have a full-time facility there. But we would ask them, from a course manager point of view, to come in and provide service to areas of the state that are currently underserved. And this gives us the allowance, the bill would give us the allowance to be able to pay for the cost to deliver this life-saving program where it is not being delivered today and doesn't pencil out from a public cost point of view or from a private company point of view.
And it is worth noting, just for the benefit of others who have already figured it out, that the graph that Mr. Costales is referring to is part of the testimony, the director's testimony in OLIS. That's what Representative Benz and I are looking at.
Please. Thank you, Mr. Chair. With that, though, Mr. Chair, I'd be more than happy to answer any questions about the program or the history of what we've been able to do over this past 12 years, because it is a bright and shining example. And actually, out of the 99 session, this particular bill was noted as one of the top five bills passed by that session that year.
Very good. We do have a number of other people who will be testifying as well. But are there questions for either of the gentlemen? Representative Gorsuch and Representative Lively.
Sounds like a really successful program. I just have one quick question on the issue about reimbursement to the programs, the program operators. It says may not exceed $210. That's on the front page of line 8. Is there a normal standard? Does it fluctuate depending upon who's offering the training?
Jerry and Vice Chair Gorsuch. Generally speaking, most of the requests that are coming in from the providers, public and private, that are allowed the reimbursement, and it subsidizes so that the cost of the parent or team is lower, will tend to hover around that $190 to $210 mark. The public sector involved in this program are not allowed to profit. So the only two income sources are the state reimbursement and the parent or teen fee, and it is to equal the cost of the program. Private, by rule, are allowed a small percentage of profit. That was done in a very public setting.
Mm-hmm.
But the subsidy will tend to be on the higher end of the scale. There are some, for the most part, public programs that have chosen by their school board or by their oversight body that they will provide the course for free,
mm-hmm.
and they don't charge their parents, and that comes out of the school's, if you will, general fund,
okay.
you know, and the subsidy goes along with it. In some cases, those industry, public and private, pass the full cost onto the parent to match with the subsidy from the department.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Lively.
So I have a couple of questions. One, just so I understand, so we're not talking about increasing the amount of subsidy, but enlarging the pool of people that you'd subsidize. And yet there's a statement made in here that at the current rate, the fund could last for 8 years. So is there some projection if we change this, what will happen to the fund? Or, you know, I don't know the relation. It seemed like 8 years is a long time already for the amount of whatever that fund is. But I'd just like to know if that what the projected income impact would be to the fund.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lively, I'll answer that in two parts. First, part of the bill request is to allow us to go above the 210 by amount set in rule that we would be able to additionally subsidize for low or no income families. And so it will go above 210. The second part of this is that the whole program is out of the same fund, Student Driver Training Fund. If we're going to course broker to somewhere in the state, it may end up being that it's cost more than 210 per student for the fact that someone's traveling, they're there for a week. And the cost to deliver the service, and that would tend to go above 210. What we're projecting is that currently the income from the $6 license fee that's noted in the testimony and what we're spending, the income is just slightly above what we're spending. And I would, so you know it's out there, and you'll see this in the Ways and Means Committee too. There's approximately $9 million in this account. And what we are wanting to do is invest that fund into the program to the delivery of the students, and projecting that it would be able to cover the expenses out that far, even with the adjustments that we want to make to the program.
Thank you. Can I have one more?
Follow up, please.
So the other thing I read in this, it talks about the department may provide traffic education courses in there. So I just need to understand a little bit about, does the department currently in some areas do that, or what this implies from a standpoint of the role of the department versus the schools or the counties or the private providers?
Mr. Chair. And Representative Lively, currently the department does not deliver frontline training to the students. The purpose for the request in this to allow us to be able to do that is there may be some circumstances where a public sector or private provider is not available to go to part of the state. Very fortunate that a couple of the employees of my office are certified as instructors and have actually have came to us from being an instructor and came to work for us. Mr. Warner in the back of the room is a program manager, is the prime example of that. Last piece, if we had to, probably would send, I would send Mr. Warner out to be the on-site instructor if nobody else had the ability to do it.
Sure. Thank you.
So just to pick up on Representative Lively's question for a moment, you talked about the income being just slightly ahead. If you could say some more about the intention, if this bill were to pass, how you view that stability and sustainability over the long term?
Mr. Chair? Over the the next 6 to 8 years, we would expect that we would spend down the balance. And if I could take a little side jaunt, when in the 99 session in March of 2000, we took over the program, it was a zero balance. And the in law today says that if we get to the spot where the requested subsidy amount from the providers exceeds the amount available, we would prorate. We have not, as a department, have not had to do that since 2000. We've been 100%. Prior to that, education was a prorated from them to the individual providers around the state. We would know well ahead a year or two ahead and have the conversation whether we are here related to is there a statewide interest in continuing the program and is there a fee adjustment or not, or is it something where we come back and say we need to adjust the amount of subsidy, but giving everybody clearly a year or two in advance, particularly public, since there's the only two, the fee or the subsidy. The subsidy is going to go down. They're going to pass that on to the consumer, and it's not my intent to be 60 days, 90 days in front of that saying, oh, by the way, your fees are changing. Everybody would know well ahead of time.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Nathan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a few, and I'll do them one at a time.
Thank you.
In a previous bill that we heard just a little while ago, the one regarding fees for not wreckers, dismantlers, and dealers, there was a testimony that stakeholders had been involved extensively in developing that stuff. Were there stakeholders involved in developing this? I understand it's not a completely radical departure from what we're trying to do, but it's some new stuff. So who was involved in helping develop that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nathanson, thank you. Great question. Something I didn't actually get a chance to highlight. We do have a driver education advisor committee that's made up of the folks that deliver frontline to the kids, private companies, high school, community college, and educational service districts. I believe some of those may be signed up on the testimony list to follow. We have used the driver education advisor committee well before we took over March of 2000. We created the group and essentially used them as if they were our board of directors for this program. So they have been involved in the conversation, and the list that's being brought forward in this bill in the three areas, I think at one point in time they had 9 or 10 things they would like to see improved, but that would have been too big of a bill to bring forward, and so highlighted these three particular. So they have been involved and have been engaged, and you'll get a chance to hear from some of them directly with their testimony.
And another one?
Please.
I notice further down in the bill is something that says the department may impose sanctions, and I remember Director Garrett had mentioned instead of just decertifying someone, if that was the right terminology, let's see if we can't do something other than just, you know, let's try to help them get up to speed or make improvements. So what I assume that would be established through rulemaking, because I don't see the sanctions in here. Can you give me an idea of what that means, a range of sanctions, and who would be involved in the rulemaking then?
And Mr. Chair and Representative Nathanson, the Driver Advisory Committee actually has already gone through and done that work. It's very similar to the prior panel talking about making sure everybody is on equal footing and being treated equally. The Advisory Committee went through and talked about what are the worst of the worst offenses, where you may have someone behind the wheel with a teen in the car, one-to-one, and that person is a suspended driver or may have a criminal background. We don't want that, we don't have the ability other than to say to that program, you're completely, you know, done, equal to someone forgot to put the sticker or the metal magnetic plate saying student driver training car on the side of the car. So the constituency has already gone through and said what are the highest to the lowest priorities and what are appropriate sanctions.
Okay.
None of these will be civil or monetary from the monetary point of view. The sanctions would be that we may ask them to bring in a neighboring program or a region program as a mentor and help them figure that out. It may that we give them 45 days to become compliant to make sure that all the cars have a first aid kit or all their instructors have been achieved their first aid CPR card. Whereas right now, those types of elements, we really serve a green light or a red light. We don't have the ability to mentor or train, mm-hmm. and that's the intent. It's not from a financial point of view, really from a programmatic assist point of view.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you.
Yes,
very good. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions. But we've taken up this issue several times in the past, and the challenge always seems to be how to convince more kids they should participate in the program.
Exactly.
And when I look at the chart in the materials online here, it looks as though there was some sort of a flattening out. I'm not sure what that means, starting in 08. I don't know if that's reflective of the number of kids or what. But or that whether we can interpolate from that the number of kids having flattened out. Is that correct? Or out of the total group of kids, how many are we actually educating?
Mr. Chair and Vice Chair Benz, there are, as mentioned in the testimony, approximately 25,000 teens come to the DMV field offices to receive their permit. While on permit, they then have the drive time practice, which is when they have the opportunity to do driver education prior to then getting their provisional license. We've gone between 7 and 8,000 teens have taken the program out of those 25,000. It's also interesting to note that there are thousands of those, of the 25,000, that never go get their license. They'll get their permit, but then they won't complete until they're 18. In relationship to the crash statistics and the flattening out, with the 45% to 55% decline that we've seen in Oregon, the national model said we should have only seen 9% to 12%. While I'd love to see that number keep going down, we far exceeded what would have been expected in the reduction. And some of that could have been economic based. Driving across the state was down a little bit. I'd love to be able to see the number lower, and I believe we would be able to push it lower if we had more of the teens going through the program because they outperform their peers.
Right. It sounds like if we're doing about 7,000 of 25,000, there's a lot of space in between. Mm-hmm. That we could be somehow trying to get more of these kids to take these classes. And that takes me to actually Section 3, and it suggests that if these courses aren't available out in specific areas, and I just looked at a couple, I saw that Klamath Falls doesn't seem to be offering one, and Lakeview doesn't seem to be offering one on this map, and some other places across the state. Do you have a list of the incentives or the waiver of the conditions and requirements already that you guys have developed that so we understand what it is you're willing to give away out of this package of requirements that would be imposed upon all others that offer these services? How have you determined what it is that we out here in the less served area don't have to worry about?
Mr. Chair and Representative Benz, in part of this question would be answered by those that follow up that are actually the frontline providers to the students can give you some examples. Those that I am aware of would be a situation where we may allow more of a concentration of the training time instead of doing the theory of the classroom and then go try it in the car from the theory in the classroom and go try it in the car where their things are blended together. There may be a concentrated time where the student may be able to do some of the work prior to the arrival of the instructor, may be able to do some things that parts of the program may be able to be available online. The length of the program is meant to be able to build that skill set over time, as Director Garrett experienced with his daughter trying different things behind the wheel. The length of the program may be shorter in part because we may be sending somebody in for a week under the contract. We want to keep costs low as we can. And while yet we know that the overall program has helped deliver the progress that we've seen, part of what we would like to do is make sure that everybody gets a chance at that skill development. And the reason why it's not in the bill to be very specific is because it may be different in one community than another, where they may have a place that they're able to meet and come together as a peer group for training, and other might be distributed where they do it via video conference.
Right. Well, here's what my concern is. We have 7,000 kids taking the class out of 25,000. There's something that's keeping those others from not taking it. It could be the length of time and the complication of a very good program. We're willing to squeeze that down in some areas because people aren't, we're willing apparently to jettison some of this, whatever it is. We don't have any rules yet that apply to what it is we're going to drop that would be helpful if we knew, because they should go right to the heart of what probably isn't necessary, or at least is least necessary. And maybe that would allow more of those that aren't taking the program now to take it, or at least incent them to, because maybe it doesn't take as long. Really what this goes to, of course, is trying to get more of those. It's a balancing act, as I know you're yes. Nationally recognized in this stuff, so there's got to be some sort of a balancing there that gets more of those kids in, because it's a great program, and I'm just wondering if this isn't an opportunity to do exactly that, given this recognition, and in some areas of the state we're not offering anything. I'm going to step away from that. And go to Section 4, and I just want to know how many times we have actually imposed sanctions and how many people have we out of the, I don't know how many people offer this, but maybe you can give us a number and then tell us how many have we've actually imposed sanctions upon.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pence, appreciate your previous comments because I agree wholeheartedly. There are 56 providers currently in the state and operating 158 different sites around the state. I can speak to that. I know personally there were two that have been decertified and are out of the program. In both those cases, the department actually went forward and filing under a law the legislature recently had passed under the False Claims Act, program providers that were submitting names and students that were not actually following the guidelines of the program. So not only were they removed from the program in that particular case, working with the Attorney General's office, they went to court and then had fees recovered back to the department because of the actions of the providers in those two cases.
And my last follow-up. My understanding is that there were at one time somewhere around 150 providers, and I grab that number out of the air, and it's dropped pretty dramatically. How long ago were those folks decertified?
Chair Reed and Representative Benz, they weren't decertified. They're two change in the way of how we list it. They're at one point in time through the Department of Education, they counted the number of high schools that were providing it, even though it may have been myself as the company, and I may have been working in every one of your individual high schools. The list used to include all of the high schools, all of the programs. We're dealing directly with the 58 entities that are delivering at 158 sites. That's first. The second was just after 2000, the legislative body asked for a review of how the highway fund was being used, money that comes from the gas tax and money that comes from driver license fees. The time when this program was run under the Department of Education, the requisite was you needed to be a high school student. It is now tied to the licensing process. So that is, there were programs that dropped out because high schools dropped out because they were teaching to high school students, not to those that were on their way with a permit, moving their way to a license. And we did have some companies that chose not to move to that particular model, and then that's when they dropped off the master list.
Good. Yeah. No questions? Representative Gorsuch?
Is this, are the sanctions based on complaint-driven processes, or do you do a routine review? How does that work?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gorsuch, again, great question. We do have one FTE that does circle the state to all of those locations. The attempt minimally is to be at every location once every 3 years. We are able to provide an on-site review once every 2 years. So that is from our side going out and checking that everything is there and all the student records are accurate. At the same time, we do have at times parents that may call in and have a complaint about how their teen was treated or the element of the program or what they saw. First and foremost, we ask that provider and that parent have a conversation, see if they can work it out first. But there are some cases that we may go in and follow up if there seems to be continued disagreement.
Thank you. Very good. Unless there are Representative McEwen, then Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Chair Reed. Representative Benz, I appreciate your comments. You are thinking very much along the lines I was as I was sitting here. And looking at the map, I see some very vacant areas, and it appears as though, particularly from a parent's perspective, wanting to save lives and get kids safely through those teen years, that there may be some of that proverbial low-hanging fruit out in the rural areas that we haven't had a chance to attract to the program. And I think one of the questions I have is, how are you partnering with school districts? I know this does not come through the Department of Education any longer, but is there an incentive for a rural school district like the Lost Rivers or Powers or that are out there to participate and get those kids in a program?
Jerry and Representative McEwen. In the public sector areas, I mentioned there's no financial incentive because they basically have to break even and they have to generally forecast ahead what do they think it's going to cost because they have to balance the 210 subsidy with the parent fee. And the ability to then, whether they, with their staff, have them trained to understand the classroom side of teaching driving and then the behind-the-wheel side of teaching driving, or do they want to hire a contractor to come in underneath their name to be the provider. We do have a behind-the-wheel and classroom curriculum that was developed by the industry that 95-plus percent of the providers use. So they don't have that cost. But sometimes there's a perception that this is a program that loses money, that they don't have full recovery, or when they pencil it out, the parent cost is just higher than what their community might actually be willing to pay. And unfortunately, as representatives, it's a little bit of a balancing act in relation to, we try as best we can with mentors that are available in the area that can go in and help a community get started if they would like to what it would take. The compliance officer in my office would do the same thing, step out of the compliance role and go through and say, this is what it would take to put a program in. And more than happy if someone is interested. I do know that at times it's a parent, it may be a principal, it may be a school board member from the local community that says, we need to do this. And unfortunately, it's after tragedies sometimes. But it's really, it's voluntary if they want to do it or not.
Follow up, Jerry.
Please.
I've worked in a lot of these very small rural schools, so that's where my heart lies, and I understand how difficult it is for parents in rural communities to find access to programs for their children, and it can be a financial burden for lots of reasons. How could an ESD participate as a more global potential provider for our greater rural areas of the state? If a smaller school district could not, like, you have 10 kids, it's really hard to pull this off. But if you're in an ESD where you're serving 6 very rural schools, maybe you could do something different.
Ms. Chair and Representative McEwen, there are ESDs in the program, and they are allowed by law to be a direct provider of the program. And so if there's a local school that would like a, either through the community college network or through the educational service district network, they have the ability to ask. Not all ESDs and community colleges currently are providing it, though. But that is a service delivery they are allowed to do under the same rules.
So,
go ahead. So
do you have some thoughts as to how we might incentivize them to participate?
Mr. Chair and Representative McEwen, I think with the adaptive strategies piece of this particular bill, what we're wanting to do is to see what pieces are going to work. And I do agree with Representative Bence's, what he was talking about is that we may learn from that in a way that actually increases participation in areas currently served, where we may adjust the way we deliver the program. But one of the, it's just the same focus that you're expressing. There are big gaps in this map, and the children and parents in those areas are no less important than anybody else, and I want to get it delivered to more spots within the state.
Thank you. To my point exactly, the parents of those students in the rural areas have just as much responsibility for the safety of their children as the people where the red dots are, so I would continue to focus on that. Thank you.
Representative McEwen. I think that's what we're all interested in. Representative Cameron?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Director. Thank you for being here, Troy. Thank you. A couple questions. You mentioned in 99 the balance was zero, and it's currently $9 million. Do you know in 99 how many students were going through the program at that time and how many are going through today?
Mr. Chair and Representative Cameron, I'll need to go back. I don't have the book in front of me that has the number. I do have access to those and can follow up. It was more than today, but it was also a requirement at that time that you just had to be a student in high school. And the change in the 99 legislation tied this to the license, and you had to have a permit in order to be eligible to take the course. And that is the way it is today. Once a teen at 16 goes in and gets their license, if they take driver training, it's no longer part of the license requirement. Now it's for the good of training, or a parent may be doing it for an insurance discount, and the subsidy won't count. It has to be during that permit phase. When that happened, the audience of the teens available shrunk to a much smaller set of kids. The numbers are less today than it was in the 98-99 time, and I don't have it. The numbers in front of me go back that far. I'd have to follow up.
So that was the result of a policy change that the legislature made. Correct. In tying it to a different point in process.
Okay, that's interesting. And then the second thing then, that would, when I look at the graph of the reduction in injuries and death crashes, we have less people going through it, but there's a reduction in that. So how do we correlate this program to that?
Ms. Chair and Representative Cameron, this graph is of all teenagers, whether they've taken the course or not. And this graph really highlights what the provisional license law has done inside these numbers, those that have taken driver education are better than their peers. Mm-hmm. So this particular graph doesn't matter whether they've taken driver training or not. It's all of them. And there's been a reduction in the number of teenagers with licenses as the population swings, but not 49 or 50%. It's more closer to the 10 to 12% number. So there is a definite change in what's happening.
Last question. Thank you. Thank you very much. And you mentioned that there would be no monetary, what's the reference?
Monetary?
Monetary, if I do something wrong.
Sanction.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Slap my hand, whatever you call it. But in section 4B, it does say reduction or denial of reimbursement. Would that not be monetary?
Mr. Chair and Representative Cameron, in a certain way, you could say that may be that's a financial piece. The object there is, in some cases, if they turn in the subsidy to us and there are errors that are in there, in working with them, we don't have the ability to say you've got to come as a compliant and with these pieces. And essentially, what this bill would allow us to do is say you have to commit, and you said you were going to commit this last year to these improvements. Have you done them or not when that reimbursement request comes in? To levy a civil penalty of $500 or whatever, that's not in the bill and that's not the intent.
Thank you.
Thanks. Further questions? Representative Parrish.
So just real quick question, checkbook question. So I'm looking at the fiscal impact statement. So there's $10 million in the fund. And the anticipated costs of $14,300 associated with rule and development adoption, is that paid for out of that fund, or is that a general fund need?
Chair Reed and Representative Parrish, thank you. That comes out of the Student Driver Training Fund directly, okay. And that's the lawyer review time from the Attorney General's office to make sure they're following and doing appropriately with the rules that we have been given authority to do under statute.
Sure, yeah, I guess I do. Where is the fund coming from, and can you give us a history on that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Cameron, it's $6 for every license and new license or renewal license goes into the Student Driver Training Fund, and that's it. That's what makes up the subsidy and allows us to operate the state program that then is matched with the parent and teen fee. It's plus or minus roughly $2 million a year, and currently in relationship to the spending is $1.7 to $1.8 million a year. So that's why the balance is growing a little bit.
Well, so thank you, Mr. Chair. When we extended the license from four, didn't we go from 4 to 8 years?
Yes, sir.
Can you talk about the history of the $6 and what's occurred there?
Mr. Chair and Representative Cameron, what we saw was a spike in revenue because people, instead of coming every 4 years, they were coming in and paying an 8-year fee. It was $3, then it became $6.
Okay.
We knew it. We looked at it. We saw that bulge in the incoming revenue. What's on the other side of the bulge? People aren't coming in years 5, 6, 7, and 8. So we purposely let the cash balance grow so that we smoothed out the revenue and didn't end up having to come back, you know, to you 3 or 4 years later.
Thank
saying
you.
We spent all that money and now we're in a deficit.
Help us, yeah.
We purposely did that, and in turn, Mr. McClellan with DMV also looked at work smoothing and license smoothing and kind of taper that out a little bit so that it wasn't too big of a spike and too big of a dip.
And we appreciate
Thank
that very
Thank
much.
You. Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Representatives.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks for your testimony. I wonder if you could comment on, and I won't pin you down to an exact number right now, but for every one serious crash we have, the fiscal impact that would have. Because what we're talking about is an investment in a subsidy to make sure more student drivers are safe drivers, which will reduce the number of accidents and crashes, both fatal and non-fatal. I mean, even a fender bender is going to have significant economic consequences, both from ODOT, from a local jurisdiction level, and from just congestion level, people stuck in traffic. And do you have data on that, or could you comment on that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Davis, thank you. Approximately, is that there's various studies that indicate any time there's a fatality, you are hovering around that $1 million mark, mm-hmm. $900,000, $1.1 million. And that would encompass just in relationship to the scene, mm-hmm. and the cost there, but also years of life lost.
Mm-hmm.
Traffic injuries and traffic deaths tend to scale to the young.
Mm-hmm.
In relationship to injury, there have been figures out there that talk about an injury-related crash is $45,000 to $50,000 mm-hmm. on average, and property damage will range anywhere from $3,000 to $10,000 mm-hmm. related for damage and for scene management and from lost productivity because of road closure.
Thank you.
There's one last one. So for low-income student, how do you do the means test on that? Student comes in and...
Mr. Chair and Representative Parrish, this is going to come from the personal side of what I don't want to get involved and know individuals' income status and what their situation may be. But yet they have a financial transaction with that frontline provider, whether it's a public school or with a private school. What we will be intending to do is asking if that conversation, that's where the information is shared. One of the easy ones to use is because for the most part these are kids that are in school. You know, let's look at the free or reduced lunch program. Do they already qualify for a program that they then can show that then says they fall into this category without asking for any more information that they have already provided or they've already proven, and not to me. I don't want that as a state agency.
So the quick follow-up then. So somebody is checking a free and reduced status, or there's some, I just don't walk in and say my kid needs this. And
Ms. Chair and Representative Parrish, that would be the expectation of the rules. They verify that, and as a vendor, that they've done, that they have identified that, because they will then send us a reimbursement request at a different rate. So we're going to ask them that they verify it.
I'm going to follow up one more time. Do you ever audit those vendors to see that they have made that ask, or you just take that on good faith?
Ms. Chair and Representative Parrish, it's not allowed today, so there's nothing for us to even check. It would be in the future. If we do allow for a higher reimbursement for low or no income, that would be something in the student record. Our compliance officer would go to look to see that they have some sort of reference to verify that that was the case.
Thank you.
There are three other people who want to testify on the bill. We appreciate your diligence and very well-informed answers. Rich Hansen, Don Davis.
I think I'm reading that right.
Tamara,
and
the one I did with
Sandra Bishop.
I think I used the last
one.
Let me see.
Sure. Please.
I
just keep
on
coming.
People
tonight, too.
Whoever would like to start, begin by introducing yourself, and I'm glad to hear from you.
Chair Reed, committee members, I'm Don Davis, and I'm representing Portland Community College today. I'd like to go on the record as being in support of House Bill 2246. 64, sorry.
Just to be clear.
Dyslexic, but
no problem.
64. PCC offers driver education courses in at 10 different locations, from Newburgh to Southeast Portland, in 6 high schools and 4 PCC centers and campuses. And if this additional subsidy would really help us reach a population that is underserved for driver education. And that's the reason PCC is always looking at ways to increase our accessibility to the community, and we feel it would have a very positive impact to that end.
Thank you. Mr. Hansen?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rich Hansen. I'm representing OTSEA, which is the Oregon Driver Traffic Safety Education Association. Along a bunch of other things, I'm also the chair of the Driver Ed Advisory Committee, although I'm not speaking to that today. We support the bill. We would love to see it pass because we believe that it will increase access to driver education to kids who are currently underserved. The first is obviously the financially for kids that can't get driver education, and we would like to be able to somehow provide it to them. There were several different situations where the last session, HB 2140, where we tried to progressively require driver education prior to licensing for all teen drivers, and one of the objections of the committee and of the legislature was that we couldn't provide funding for those kids or provide access to those kids who couldn't afford it. And this bill gives the opportunity to increase the access to those kids by identifying those that are on free and reduced lunch or some other measure to provide some added reimbursement so that they can afford it. The other piece that we really appreciate about this bill and endorse is that it increases access to driver education for kids who currently don't have access to it because there's no provider. I have a heart for kids on the other side of the mountains that don't have access to driver education because they drive in a harder environment. Mm-hmm. They drive on more rural roads. They have more possibility of crashes because they drive further distances, and they also drive in more inclement weather. and they need driver education just as much as kids on this side of the mountains. And I want to, I think that this gives, with the adaptive strategies, provides an opportunity to help these kids get driver education. One of the things we know is that motor vehicle crashes are the number one killer of kids in Oregon and in the nation. And if we can find a way to implement the four E's of traffic safety, which are education, engineering, enforcement, and EMS, using education to help these kids reduce their risk of a crash, would reduce the needs for the other things, especially the EMS. We also think this is a good thing, or a good bill, because of the sanctions that are progressively applied in order to improve driver education, not remove driver educators. We want to keep driver educators there because obviously we don't have as many providers as we need. And the best way to do that is to work together to get better and motivate people who sometimes might be reticent to change to actually make those changes and deliver quality driver education. So we believe quality driver education for all students is necessary and is a good thing. And we do that by having everybody delivering quality curriculum under the same standards and conditions. It's important for us to make sure that we have compliance with those high standards of delivery. And one of those roles that the TSD can do is provide those sanctions. I would like to I'd like to kind of conclude with a statement from a legislator that I just happened to find a quote in the paper. It says that it's not just our own children. If we have the means, then it's time to start supporting the reforms that will help other people's children too. Mm-hmm. So,
thank you very much.
Thank you.
Are there questions? Representative Betts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, can you express what the additional funding would be? I'm just curious about the real numbers. How much money are we talking about?
The actual fiscal impact?
What does this bill change from what you've been doing?
Well, currently, to give you an example, I also work at Tiger Tollen School District as my place where I teach driver education. And if a student wants to take driver education and is on the free and reduced program, they can bring a letter and they can say, they can present that at registration. And at that time, they get a discount. They are required, if they're on the reduced, it's only $100 tuition to take the course. If they're on free, it's $50. And our normal tuition is $300. We have to absorb that cost by within our school district in order to cover the cost so that we can provide service to those kids. I don't know how much TSD is going to suggest as an increase in the amount of reimbursement, but I know that would help offset our costs because we're going to continue to offer that to our kids. We believe that kids need driver education, and that's what we're going to provide.
Okay, I'm still not following how much you get for a child. Can you just give me the number? Is it $10, $100? How much is the department paying you today? How much will they pay you in the future? How much more will you get?
Chair Reed, Representative Benz, we currently get $210 reimbursement, or roughly about there. I think our average was $205 last year, and we charge $300, so our total cost for kid is $505. Is that right? Correct.
And so your hope is that you would get an additional how much from the department in the future? Your hope. How much more would you like the department to give you? You've been getting 205. How much more do you want them to give you?
Chair Reed, Representative Benz, I'm not sure. It would be nice to get the amount offset in that we discount, but I know that that's not going to be possible simply because of the amounts that are there. But if we could see an increase of $40 or $50 per kid if we have a free and reduced, I think that would help offset our costs.
Well, go ahead. So you'd go from 205 to 255.
Chair Reed, Representative, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions?
Thank you, Representative Cameron. Yeah, thank you. We've heard a lot about the term free and reduced lunch. How is that how does a student qualify? What's the process they go through to qualify for free and reduced lunch?
Chair Reed, Representative Cameron, they have to make an application and show a financial statement, and it's handled through the school district. So the school district has a policy, and I'm not quite familiar with exactly how that process works, but I know that they make application and show financial means during that application in order to qualify.
Representative Cameron, I think that's a federal program that, that mm-hmm. and yeah. perhaps Representative Doherty is nodding. Do you have knowledge of this one?
Not what the dollar amounts are, but it's based on poverty level. And it's usually X percent below poverty mm-hmm. level.
So it's a federally established number is the poverty level.
That right. qualifies a student eligible for either a reduced or free lunch.
Right. So. Okay, I understand that. It'd be interesting to know, but how do I, as a parent, you have prove to, that or enroll my student in that?
Yes, please.
So as a former queen of the lunch ladies, I can answer this one. I used to run the food service program in the Westland and Wilsonville schools. Parents make application. The application is processed. There actually is no need for anybody to show proof of income. If they are TANF eligible, they would check that box. Schools don't verify it. If they are food stamp eligible, they would show that. A foster child is immediately accepted. That's something we can verify, the foster status. So those kids are automatically qualified. Foreign exchange student would follow the income of the family who's coming. So if the family was hosting, and the audit requirement to verify that is only 3% poll of your total applicants in the course of a school year that you would randomly pull from a numeric system, pop up a random number generator, pull them out of the file, and then call those parents back in. And then if they actually can't prove, they're removed, but it's only a 3% audit request. Sorry.
Thank you.
Thanks. I don't see any other questions. Thank you very much. And Sandra, you didn't come up this time, so does that suggest you are going to bring your colleague this time?
Right.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair Reed, members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Sandra Bishop, and I appreciate the time to be able to address this important issue this afternoon. I'm here today representing the Driving School Association of Oregon, and Lori Nosek is with me. Lori owns and operates a commercial driving school that serves the Portland metro area. She's a private provider of the ODOT Transportation Safety Division approved teen driver education courses. It's a mouthful, but part of what she has to pay attention to is being ODOT approved. There's approximately a dozen commercial driving schools operating in Oregon. These are private businesses that are all regulated under the ODOT DMV, the Department of Motor Vehicles, and then they are also regulated under Troy's division if they choose to provide the state-approved teen driver ed programs. Approximately 30% of the teen drivers in Oregon who take driver's ed courses are taking them through private providers. Usually the private providers from the commercial driving schools are under contract with a public school district to provide those services. We're here today to support the bill. The Driving School Association really supports this major intent of House Bill 2264 to provide equity and fairness in reimbursement to all providers of the state-approved courses, and to get this money freed up that's in this training fund, to get that money freed up to allow the subsidies that we're talking about for kids and families that can't afford it. It's very important to make teen driver's ed more available in the state and available for teens. We're really encouraged to be working and continue to work in partnership with ODOT TSD on these driver ed programs. This really, the bottom line here is to enhance the safety of young drivers and the public out on our highways. So, we're really here to support this bill. So, and Lori's especially here if you have any questions about some of the technical aspects of it.
Very good. Thank you. Ms. Nosek, do you want to make any comments, or are you here primarily to answer questions?
Just answer questions, yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Reed, I did have one piece of information that there was a question, and I apologize, Chair Reed, members of the committee. I don't remember who asked the question, but there was a question about the number of teens that were taking driver's ed in 1999, and these figures are available in the annual Transportation Safety Action Plan. And according to that document, in 1999, there were 16,000 teens or kids that were taking driver's ed. And then the last figures that I I heard, I think were for 2011, and it was around, I think it was 6,700, but it was a little less than 7,000, just in answer to that previous question.
Very good. Thank you. I'm going to ask for questions, but I want, before I do, I want to note the time and the fact that we have one more bill that I'd really like to get to today because there's someone who has traveled the distance to be with us. So are there any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. That completes the list of folks who have signed up to testify on House Bill 2264. Is there anyone else who would like to testify? I don't see any. So I'm going to close the. Before I close it, comment. I think there's a lot here, and it's certainly our intention to come back to it. But we do have a little more investigation to do, so I think we'll come back to this bill hopefully very shortly. So close the public hearing on House Bill 2264. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2265.
Troy. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 2265 permits use of photo radar in highway work zones on interstate highways and when no highway workers are present. Eliminates sunset of provision allowing use of photo radar in highway work zones. Stipulates conditions for issuing of speeding citation. Requires Department of Transportation to conduct process and outcome evaluation. Includes public acceptance of photo radar once each biennium to report to the Legislative Assembly. The fiscal impact statement reads no expenditure impact. The revenue impact statement reads no revenue impact.
Thank you. And who are we going to? The director, please. And Troy again. You had a rest, but you're back. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again, Matthew Garrett, Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. To beg your indulgence, Brian Gray, who is with Knife River Corporation, who is also a very strong partner. He's a member of the Association General Contractors Contracting Executive Team or Table. He's a partner, a strong partner in this, and I think he will carry a conversation here. I will be very brief in light of the time. What we do know, Mr. Chairman, is in Oregon we average about 500 work zone crashes each year. We lose about 9 people each year on average. In 2007, I testified before this body, different folks, but requesting the department and its ability to use photo radar work zone and highway on the highways. The bill passed. We certainly celebrated. However, the bill then included a sunset date. House Bill 2265 would lift that sunset on the use of photo radar in work zones, and it would allow us to use this proven safety tool on a permanent basis here. House Bill 2265 would also expand the use of this safety tool on interstates. That was a conversation that didn't play itself out at the time. Obviously, the interstates, you have greater speeds, you have greater exposures to the men and women who are working to maintain, construct, as well as drive through there. House Bill 2262 would also allow photo radar even when workers are not present. This acknowledges the fact that work zones often carry greater risks to the traveling public due to the change of lanes, the configurations. We actually put the risk out there in terms of the work zone here. We try to mitigate that, but the geometry of the roadway shifts. We like to slow people down. It also acknowledges the fact that the motorists themselves who are traveling too fast is at greater risk of injury or death. We'd like to slow these people down. We think that'll protect both the workers as well as the motorists. This is a tool that works. Let's expand the use of this proven safety tool to reduce speed, save lives in the work zones across this state. Mr. Chairman, what I'd like now is to have Troy share some of the specific findings of a pilot that we ran up in the Portland metro area on Highway 30.
Thank you. Mr. Costales.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Troy Costales, Administrator of the Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. And as Mr. Garrett pointed out, we did have a pilot project for this law. It was Beyond Avenue on US 30 in the Portland area. And as the picture depicts, one of the things that the legislative body put in place was adequate, fair, and lots of warning to individuals coming into the work zone, as well as then that there would be the potential of photo radar being used for speed enforcement in the area. And so on the map, moving from left to right, the motorist that starts to enter the work zone will encounter first and foremost a sign saying that there's road work ahead. They then do see what speed limit is within that particular stretch of road, with the additional warning in writing to say that photo radar is being used within the zone. As they approach down the road with an adequate amount of speed in order to recognize and slow themselves down if they are exceeding the speed limit at that time, then they would approach and a sign would say to them, your speed is, and let them know what their actual speed is before they encounter a marked law enforcement vehicle with a uniformed officer at the control of being able to take the photos. Across the state, the legislature has limited the number of jurisdictions that are allowed to run photo radar, and so that's one of the inhibiting factors of use of this tool, is it is only being put in place where cities have decided to run a photo radar law enforcement activity, because there is a direct connection to the courts in relationship to filing of these citations. Generally speaking, what then happens with the photo following up after this it has been taken is that the officer will then try to verify that the owner of the vehicle matches the general description of the operator of the vehicle. At that moment, and that moment alone, there are quite a few of those citations that are just never even issued. The photo may be taken, but the citation is not issued. There's no match. When that photo citation is then sent to the offender, it follows the already pre-described process that's in statute today and has been in statute for over a decade about how that citation is to process through court, how the individual can file a certificate of innocence to indicate that it is not them, and they can show that and share that with the court in that particular process. With this particular operation, we went in and looked at the location, did a speed evaluation prior to construction, speed evaluation when construction started, speed evaluation when the photo radar was in place, and a speed evaluation post. And during the time of photo radar enforcement being present and active, 23% in relationship to the number of those that were speeding, 23% reduction coming through that work zone. And that is the bottom line piece, is to try and mitigate risk for those individuals working on the ground and those that are in the vehicles, so that if something does occur, we have a chance of survivability and less damage and less injury. We did look at four or five other project potentials around the state to put this in place. In some cases, it was a situation where it was an unsafe area to put the law enforcement vehicle, so we did not put that in place. Most recently, there was a project identified where just the current congestion, without even anything being done, the road was not even at the speed limit. And so they've just deemed that was not an appropriate place to put it. And as I mentioned earlier, we're limited because only certain cities, and right now it is Portland, Medford, Beaverton, and Milwaukee are the only locations that are currently running photo radar, so that then becomes the only place where we can even put in a particular pilot project. So it was successful, and would ask for your approval to lift the sunset so that we can make the improvements as we did on Yeon to other places in the state to keep both the individuals on the ground and people in the vehicles going through a changed environment safer.
Just before here for Mr. Gray, one question to be more specific. When you said 23%, is that 23% fewer people who are speeding, or 23% lower speeds, or what did the 23% mean?
Just give me one quick second, if you would,
sorry.
Mr. Chair.
No problem.
The average reduction in the number of speeding vehicles was 23.7% fewer. So those exceeding the speed limit dropped.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Gray.
Well, thank you, Chair Reed, members of the committee. My name is Brian Gray. I'm the president of the Knife River operations in the Northwest region, which includes all of Oregon. So we've got operations up and down Highway 97 from Klamath Falls up to Bend and from Southern Oregon up here to Portland. And so we're in heavy highway construction, and we really do appreciate the partnership that our company and our industry has with ODOT in trying to make work zones safer for our workers and for the general public. I handed out a picture, and I just want to try to paint a picture verbally of what our workers go through, and a lot of them are at night on interstate paving, on construction, in order to avoid congestion. A lot of our work is done at night. And when you do that, we've got two things that are really working against us. One is just visibility and the lack of light. Also, the congestion is a whole lot lighter, therefore traffic speeds a lot faster. And so, you know, I have this top picture is a typical interstate highway, two lanes. It could be Highway 30 on Yiyan, similar operation. We basically divide that road in half, and our paving crew takes one lane for our construction, and the other lane is for traffic. And it's divided by a cone, and that's what separates us, the workers, from the traffic. And typically, the lane of traffic is about 14 to 16 feet wide. And so we have a lot of times traffic coming by us at 40 to 50 to 60, 70 miles an hour from our workers about 2 to 3 feet away from our workers. And so the workers that are the most at risk are the two pictures I've got down below. We've got what we call a dump person, and they're backing in the dump trucks. And so one of the things is our trucks have to get out of the traffic and slow down to get into the line to go dump their load. That in itself can be dangerous as they're slowing down to get into the front of the paver, speeding trucks or traffic coming behind, and that's where a possibility for an injury would occur for a traveling public. That guy in the yellow vest there is the dump person, and he's literally standing on the dotted line, on the center line. That's where the joint is at. That's where the paver overlaps one another. And so he's literally standing on that center line with you know, maybe 2 or 3 feet away from the traveling public. The other ones are the screed operators, the actual asphalt machine operators. And again, you can see the guys, they're continually looking out to see where they're going to make sure that that lap joint on the center line is lined up and that we're getting good smooth joints. And so he's got his head sticking out really on the other side of the center line, and we've got trucks coming by there. I go to a lot of our safety meetings, and I had a young gal who has two children come to me and say, you know, have you been out on our I-84 project? We were paving just east of Multnomah Falls, and she said it was a night operation, and I encourage you to come out, Brian, to see what we're going through. I'm scared to death to be out on this project. And as the manager of an operation, I'm not going to ask anybody to go out and do something that I wouldn't want to go do myself. And so I took her up on that and went out one evening, got out there about midnight, and I parked off on the shoulder and went out, and I first stepped on the screed between those two guys in the orange, and I was watching what we were doing, and we had a speed reduction of 55 miles an hour. It's a white sign that says 55 miles an hour, no photo enforcement or anything else like that. Unfortunately, signs and reader boards and everything else that says please slow down, construction ahead, they don't do it, especially at 2 o'clock in the morning. The triple trailers coming through there up the gorge are going 65 to 70 miles an hour. I didn't believe it until I went out there myself, and they're literally, the wind from these trucks, and the trailers are swaying back and forth. They're literally blowing cones over, and you can feel the gust of wind come by there. And we've got people working 2 to 3 feet away from this. And so that's the picture I'm trying to paint. And I had a hard time. I wanted off that job because I was scared myself, and that's not what we need to have. And so I'm totally supportive of photo enforcement, photo radar. The more enforcement we can have on our jobs, people don't slow down for the amber-colored flashing construction lights like they do red and blue lights or a sign or truck drivers on the radio saying there's a you know, photo radar up here. They slow down. It works. We've got projects this year down on I-5 between on Sexton Hill. We're widening out the truck lanes out there. It's a great project, but I'm going to have crews out there for 3 to 4 months at night doing the same exact thing with trucks going by them. It's at night, and we're asking for a speed reduction to go from 65 down to 55. We have to ask for that, and that's going to be, I mean, we need to have some sort of enforcement to help us with that. And so that's why we're so much in support of this. I don't want to end on a somber note, but I wouldn't be doing my job, and the reason I'm so passionate about this is I got a phone call, the dreaded phone call that any boss or any person would ever want to have, and that was that we lost one of our my co-workers on the Highway 99 job this year. Was struck by an impaired driver out on Highway 99 and was fatally injured. Greg Priest was 47 years old, had a 6-year-old boy at home. I had to go. I was in Klamath Falls when I got the phone call. I drove all night to only go meet his dad that next morning and be with the family. And you know, I just, this, it's just too near and dear to me to not show up and talk about the importance. I've met with our coworkers and the team all summer that year, just 6 months ago, and I promised them I'd do anything I could to help them make their job safer so they go home to their six-year-old Mason and go home to their mom and dads like they need to go home and like we all want to. And so I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I strongly support this bill on behalf of AGC and the Highway Council and all of the other construction companies that are part of that. We strongly encourage you to pass this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Gray. Representative Doherty.
And I would just like to echo what you said. For a dozen years, I drove Coombe River Gorge, and after midnight, there is nothing but triple trailers on there, and it's very dark. It's very rutted until you come in and repave it. And what I would see trucks, I mean, I was going over the speed limit and was being passed by trucks. And they don't slow down during construction zones. So, and neither do pedestrians. Those of us that also drive I-5 through the Iowa Street Viaduct Project, which went on, and that was, the workers were in the middle and they were fairly contained, but people did not slow down there, especially after midnight. So I just strongly, you know, I would go through and I would just say, how can they do this when you've got workers out there? So we echo what you say, and we.
I appreciate that.
And I support this very much.
Thank you, Representative Doherty. Other questions? I sense some momentum here, so I don't see anyone else who has signed up for House Bill 2265. Is there anyone else who'd like to testify? Thank you. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2265 and open a work session on House Bill 2265. Representative Bentz.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2265 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Bentz has moved House Bill 2265 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any question? Is there any discussion? Any objection? Same. Thank you. The bill moves to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Representative Lively, are you okay to carry this one?
I'd be glad to. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Lively will carry. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2265. And before you leave, there's one more bit of business. I need to reopen work session on House Bill 2262 and beg the forgiveness of the committee. I was looking at the wrong line. Those asterisks on our agenda confused me. House Bill 2262 does not, in fact, have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. So I would like to ask unanimous consent that we rescind that motion to include the Ways and Means subsequent referral. Is there any objection to that? I don't see any. So that is so ordered. And House Bill 2262, being before us and having removed the Ways and Means referral, is still headed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And I'd like to ask Representative Davis if he'd be willing to carry that.
Be my pleasure.
Thank you very much. I don't see any imminent arrival of Ramona, so I think we've done that correctly. We'll reclose the work session on House Bill 2262. And unless there's anything else from the duty order, we'll adjourn the committee. Thank you very much. And remember, Monday night, 3 o'clock. Monday afternoon, 3 o'clock.